You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as we've heard in the news, there's a whole lot of camping going on in Wisconsin this year. We'll ask you to share your thoughts about camping. Love it? Hate it? We want to know.
First, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is one of the most controversial trade deals we've seen in the last few years. It also happens to be one of the few things the presidential candidates agree on. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have said that they have opposed the trade deal that was negotiated by the Obama administration.
Clinton initially supported the deal as Secretary of State, but voiced her opposition last year and has argued against it on the campaign trail. Trump has been opposing the TPP since before he announced his candidacy. Here's a clip of him talking about the deal at the second presidential debate.
You called it the gold standard of trade deals. You said it's the finest deal you've ever seen.
No.
And then you heard what I said about it, and all of a sudden you were against it.
And here was Clinton's response.
The facts are, I did say I hoped it would be a good deal, but when it was negotiated, which I was not responsible for, I concluded it wasn't.
While both candidates are criticizing the deal, sometimes speaking at the same time, there are some dairy farmers in Wisconsin who see it as something that could be good for them and for the economy.
Here to tell us why some in the dairy industry may support the TPP is Mike North. He's the president of Commodity Risk Management Group, which provides consulting and brokerage services for people in the agricultural industry. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you, Kate.
Dairy farmers are seeing the TPP as this helpful trade deal, while, as we just heard, the two major party candidates see it as harmful. So what are these candidates not taking into account on the TPP's agricultural impact?
Well, the United States agricultural industry as a whole has, over the years, always competed in a space whereby cheap food was the directive. And so over time, we've always had to work on very thin margins. We've had to employ a lot of technology. We've had to become better at every turn. And the dairy industry is certainly no stranger to making those same changes. And so as we talk about where the industry has come from, we've seen a lot of growth. We've seen a lot of reduction in costs when we talk milk on a per hundredweight basis. And so what that's allowed us to do is become a lot more competitive in the world space. And as the economies around the world have grown, the middle class has grown with it. Spending in the middle class has doubled in the last 13 years. And that's essentially been directed into two places, and that's first to the diet, which protein makes up the biggest demand piece of that, and then also to energy. And so as agriculture looks at this, it's a golden opportunity as more people around the world have more money to spend and are demanding more protein in their diet. And specifically to dairy, there is a real opportunity here, because dairy protein is among the most portable protein in the world. It doesn't require the refrigeration that, say, fresh meats would. You can move it without a lot of water, and it just makes a lot of sense to move dairy protein into those places. The United States has really put themselves over the last 10 years into a competitive advantage, and ultimately the TPP opens some doors with existing trade partners that already account for more than 50% of our export volume on an annual basis.
And ballpark for us the money at stake here, the profit at stake. How much would dairy exports rise with the TPP in place?
Well, if you go back in time and you look at on a dollar valuation basis what the growth has been in the last 15 years, we've essentially taken in the last 15 years exports from about $1 billion figure to, at our peak in 2014, just north of $7 billion. We've seen some retraction over the last couple years as both economies have softened and the U.S. dollar has gained strength against currencies around the world. But we're even after all of that, still right around $5 billion. So it's grown fivefold on a dollar basis over the last 15 years. as we go forward, by opening some doors in this region, removing some of the tariffs and the quotas that are in place, we could easily expand that by another 20%. So what was 5 today could go back to 6. What was 7 in 2014 could easily go north of $8.5 to $9 billion. And as you look at that, there's a lot of additional jobs created in the process back home as those exports increase. And so it has a lot of very good impacts back here as we're making those trades with other countries.
And Mike, what countries would be really key for the dairy industry to get access to through this trade deal? What countries would it zero in on here?
So the whole Southeast Asia market has been very, very good for us in terms of growth. We've seen a lot of increased growth with Vietnam and Japan, and we hope to continue that. Obviously, China is the one that everybody likes to talk about in that Asian market, but the bottom line is a lot of these countries that don't make the headlines, but have, you know, like we've seen in the last several years, some growth in their crude oil production, have some additional revenues, and are really trying to grow their marketplace. So, you know, some of the countries like Vietnam would be a prime example of that.
We're talking with Mike North, who is president of Commodity Risk Management Group, which provides consulting and brokerage services for people in the agricultural industry. Mike, critics of the TPP say the trade deal puts American workers in competition with lower wage ones in other countries. Do you see that as a potential drawback, a potential downside for the dairy industry?
Well, there's been a lot of criticism that's popped up as a kind of a backdraft off of NAFTA. And the reality is when we first entered into that negotiation, you know, everybody recognized the need to trade with our neighbors. That obviously has expanded. The map has gone broader. Our neighbors now are global. And bottom line is trade is very important to agriculture and to industry, period. We need to continue to trade because it's a great way to bring foreign dollars back into the United States. But I think if we learned anything through NAFTA, we learned that there's a cost to it. And we have to calculate those costs as we enter these deals. And I think where we've fallen short in some of the others has been that we've overlooked that. And in many cases, we've, you know, sacrificed the jobs that you hear about. But I think as we go to the table and we participate in these, we need to make sure as the rules are written that that's not the case going forward, that we get a fair shake, that we're not the one that gets trampled over while we open the doors for everybody else to now do business with us.
And then for a moment, walking in your shoes, how do you see yourself advising dairy farmers differently if the TPP were in place versus it not being in place?
Well, the one thing that a more global market does is it does make things a bit more volatile. And so while it does bring opportunity to the table, when economic downturns take place elsewhere in the world, it has a ripple effect right back to the markets at home. And so obviously, as we go forward in time, we need to be much more hawkish about markets as they present opportunities. You know, a prime example of that was this summer when milk prices made a nice move higher, but quickly gave that away within a matter of about 4 to 5 weeks. And so, you know, as we would walk forward in that, we would help guys manage those decisions as opportunities arise with a little bit more of a aggressive nature. I mean, the reality is over time, as I grew up, we were very dependent on our ability to produce. You know, I talked a bit about production efficiencies and our ability to drive down costs. We become least cost producers. We've done a great job at maximizing yields and milk production. And so we've depended on that heavily. But as we go forward and enter into a market where more global participation takes place and that greater volatility exists, you need to equally become invested in the marketing of your product and take that a lot more seriously. And so we would work hand in hand with farmers to help them manage those risks in the marketplace so that they're not, you know, wide open and fully susceptible to the change.
And Mike, really quickly here, with a few moments, what would happen to the dairy industry if this trade deal is not passed? You know, we're in a lame duck session. The chances that the TPP being passed don't seem, you know, highly likely. What happens to dairy?
Well, in 2014, when we overhauled the Farm Bill, we got rid of the dairy price support program. And ultimately what that did is it forced our manufacturers, our processors of dairy products to become a lot more innovative, to work directly towards meeting the client's needs, wherever that client may be. And so what that's allowed us to do is become a lot more adept at serving other marketplaces. So we'll continue to grow the export market. The TPP simply opens up some doors for us to move over some existing hurdles and hopefully expedites that process. But that will not change the fact that our processors and our dairymen are gearing towards more relationships around the world. So whether it goes or it doesn't go, it's only a matter of velocity of movement in that direction. It doesn't actually change the movement in that direction. So as it is in a free market, the people that are innovative will move forward and opportunities will still come about.
Mike, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Kate.
That was Mike North. He's the president of the Commodity Risk Management Group and told us why some members of the dairy industry are supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What do you think of when you hear pop music? Do you think of this? That was Uptown Funk, a collaboration between Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars. It won a Grammy for Best Pop Duo Group Performance in 2016.
But that might not be your cup of tea when it comes to pop music. Maybe your version of pop music sounds more like this.
That was Whitney Houston's hit single, which won a Grammy for Best Female Pop Vocal Performance in 1988. Well, those songs sound pretty different, and that might be why the term pop music is hard to pin down, because it brings something different to mind for everyone.
Our next guest is David Haidu. He's a music critic for The Nation and professor at the Columbia University School of Journalism. In his new book, Love for Sale, Pop Music in America, he takes a look at the pop genre, all its variants, and why we love it. Or love to hate it. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be talking to you.
Well, this concept of pop music or popular music, it's tough. These are moving targets. What do these phrases mean, if anything?
Well, it's frustrating because all that the phrase means literally is that the music's popular. Right? Meaning that, you know, a significant number of it appeals to a significant number of people. The term itself doesn't tell you anything about what it sounds like, what it feels like to listen to the music, what you might do while you're listening to the music, how you might use it, if it's music to listen to and alone, if it's social music, if it's music to dance to. It tells you that it's popular. But what that tells us in a secondary way is that it speaks to a particular group of people at a particular time. And that fact brings us to what's really interesting and complicated about pop music, because it really is something. It's been many, many different things over the more than 100 years that music has been popular as a mass phenomenon in this country. I mean, if we just played some hits that we hear, we recognize immediately as pop hits. But the very first multi-million-selling smash goes back to the late 19th century and the early 20th century. Do you mind if I tell you about this now?
Start in the era of sheet music, you know, when you didn't buy a recording of the music, you bought a transcription of the music so you could play it yourself at home. Start us off with that first smash.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's hard to think about music being popular in the era of, like, the horse and the horse and buggy and Gaslight, but popular songs were actually significantly more popular than the biggest pop hits of today. The songs that were most popular that sold in sheet music sold in the millions of copies, up to 4 or 5 million copies apiece, at prices of 30, 40, 50 cents, which is the equivalent of $8 to $10 today, at a time when the U.S. population was just a fraction of what it is now. So what that tells us is that pop music, popular music, was much more central to life 100-plus years ago than it is today. But it was music that was made in a very different way. So it required some musicianship. You'd have to play the music yourself at home on the piano. And it was social music. People would gather around the piano, usually on Saturday or Sunday afternoons. Families and neighbors would all get together and share the music. And some interesting things happened. And through this process, the music tended to be performed in a funky, kind of rough way, because most people, even if they had a little training at the piano, or, you know, might have a half-decent voice, were not performing on the level of professional musicians. So, you know, people were getting together and having fun without a lot of concern for polish or professionalism. And a lot of the songs were really much more daring than we would think that they would be in this kind of late Victorian, early Edwardian era. And that's really important, too. And it's really interesting, too, because it tells us another thing that's important about pop music is that it both reflects the society of its time and in many ways always challenges the standards of its time. Pop music tends to push the culture forward a little bit for a number of reasons, which I'll be happy to talk about for the next 4 or 5 hours.
We're talking to David Heydew. His new book is Love for Sale, Pop Music in America. David, I mean, we're talking about going from an era where it was sheet music to, you know, now we're downloading whatever songs we want. But there are some consistent themes I keep hearing, and one of those is every step of the way, there are some people who define themselves in opposition to popular music. This stuff, it's inferior. I'm better than the people who listen to it because I listen to more sophisticated stuff. That's never gone away, has it?
No. From the very first days of pop music in the time of sheet music, there were fierce critics of the music who saw it as demeaning, overly simplistic, dumb, mopey, mushy. And these critics most of this criticism tended to be class-based, and it tended to essentially reflect a bias against music that was made for the masses, for, in fact, the immigrant classes, and not made for the elite upper classes who could afford tickets to go to the Metropolitan Opera or to go to the symphony concerts. Pop music was always vernacular music. It was intended to speak to the common person, and for that reason, it stirred the ire of people who felt that it was their job to protect the standards of propriety and high aesthetic standards. Also, pop music has always been music for the young. And for that reason, it has always sought to challenge the standards, ways of thinking, ways of acting that parents and older people embraced. That's one of the jobs of pop music, is to help young people feel a sense of community and establish their generational identity. So pop music always sort of pushed against the times, both reflected the times and pushed against them. And we hear, even in the music of the early 20th century, a kind of a sauciness and a proto-feminism that's really staggering if you look at it today. There was a woman named Ava Tangway. Can I talk about her? Do you mind if I tell you about Ava Tangway?
Sure. Go for it.
Okay. vaudeville performer who was like the Lady Gaga or the Madonna of her day, that represented a kind of fiercely independent individual idea of womanhood that like turned upside down and inside out the notion of Victorian propriety, you know, of a proper woman who wasn't a sexual creature, wasn't assertive, wasn't aggressive, you know, was demure rather than being, you know, it's powerful. And she sang songs like I Don't Care was her big hit, sold millions of copies, and Do Anything You Want. And songs, other songs are like sexual agency and independence that older people found appalling, but young people found irresistible.
Well, another ongoing theme, I want to bring in Duke Ellington now to introduce the concept here. So nowadays, we look back and think of Duke Ellington and his composer, Billy Strayhorn, who you've written a bit about, as well as, you know, one of the classics, an innovator in American music. At the time, you write, people were criticizing him and others as making jungle music, and white journalists in particular were worried about the impact this black music was going to have on white youth. Talk about a theme that's never gone away. We're still having this conversation today in some ways, aren't we?
Yeah, we sure are. The black music in general, and jazz more specifically, and Duke Ellington more particularly, were criticized by proper music critics or elite music critics for being primitive, and the music was attacked for being savage. Now this is before a time when we thought of primitivism and savagery as being positive, you know, first of all. And it was before the notion that of pride in African heritage was widespread. But Ellington himself allowed this and upended it and exploited it to his advantage all at the same time in a really complicated way that only a master like Duke Ellington could do. He played at a club called the Cotton Club in New York that had broadcasts that went nationally, which means that it was broadcasts that went into homes, black, white, homes of people of every kind all over the country. His band was then called Duke Ellington and His Jungle Band, and he performed a kind of blackness that was a little bit of a parody of white conceptions of primitivism and savagery, but also asserted pride in African heritage at the same time. It did both things at the same time. And Ellington himself took enormous pride in his African heritage. And when he did interviews, he would talk about it. He would talk about having over 100 books of African history. Now, nobody's ever seen them. There are no pictures of them. And I'm not sure that 100 books of African history were published in the United States in the 1930s. But he understood that this would make an impact, and that was his line. I'm glad you mentioned that Take the A-Train was written by Billy Strayhorn, because, yeah, I have written about him. I wrote his biography, Lush Life.
We're talking to David Haidu, music critic for The Nation, author of the new book, Love for Sale, Pop Music in America.
And we want to hear from you. How do you feel about pop music? Has it been a genre you've always listened to, dabbled in, or have stayed away from? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Is there a pop song that you think defined a particular time, place, generation? Let us know what that song is and call 800-642-1234 or post.
Talk about pop music. I want to do it.
This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We are talking about pop music with David Haidu, music critic for The Nation, author of the new book, Love for Sale, Pop Music in America.
And we want to get your thoughts on this. What does pop music mean to you? Is there a particular song that comes to mind? Tell us why. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Are there any songs that make you think of a generation gap, either between you and maybe your parents or between you and your kids? Call 800-642-1234.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Garrett on the line in Duluth. Garrett, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Garrett?
I would just like to say that nowadays pop music isn't necessarily one specific genre. It's kind of a creole between a lot of different genres. Like, it's a lot of different artists whose songs become popular, but it's not necessarily a genre. For example, you've got Chance the Rapper, who is obviously rap music, is very popular amongst young people, but at the same time, Justin Timberlake is very popular amongst young people, and he doesn't exactly rap. He's kind of a more, like, sing-songy kind of type.
Garrett, thanks a lot for the call. It's kind of always been that way in some ways, hasn't it, David? In the 60s, you might have a protest song and a bubblegum song at the same time.
Right. I think that was even more apparent in the 1960s because the pop charts weren't splintered into, you know, 50 different charts the way they are now. If you open up Billboard today, there's a hip-hop chart, there's an R&B chart, there's a country, there's an adult contemporary chart, there are pop charts. There was a chart that quantified record sales, 45 record sales, single sales in the 1960s. Whatever was selling would show up on that chart. And you'd see in the top 20 the Beatles next to Louis Armstrong. You know, Louis Armstrong bumped the Beatles off the chart and had a number one hit with Hello Dolly, which was from a Broadway show. The same chart would have Strangers in the Night by Frank Sinatra. There were some country songs, black music, white music, music out of Detroit, soul music out of Philly, Tin Pan Alley music, sort of all together. And in those days, a lot of people from different generations were all still buying single records. But most of the buyers were still young people, and they were still seeking, generally speaking, music that spoke to them because it spoke in a language that their parents didn't get, you know, a language that their parents didn't understand or their parents just didn't like. And my son, who lives in Madison, by the way, oh. I have a son and a daughter-in-law who's a teacher in Oregon, Wisconsin. She teaches at the Prairie View Elementary School. And my son works for a political campaign. I'm not going to politicize the program. I won't say
we get plenty of that.
Which campaign he's the head of, but it is a candidate who has actual experience and actual ideas. But he, when he was in high school, he was on a kick of listening to The Who and Keith Moon. Now, I like The Who. It's classic rock. It's my generation. But he had this absorption with someone who, with a kind of music that pushed things a little far, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe a little... Now, today we listen to The Who, and it's classic rock. It's revered because of the, you know, it's baby boomer music. But, you know, he knew that that would, you know, push me a little. And that's one of the jobs that's one of the things that pop music is supposed to do for young people.
Garrett, thanks for the call. We'll go next to John with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hi. Very quickly, I just want to point out, I'm 16 years old, so I was about 14, 15, I think, for the Beatles hit. And I, for one thing, for kids that age, then the Beatles were simply astonishing in their appearance. Just the Britishness, everything about them was really astonishing. And also, I bet every kid that was 14 or 15 years old in 1964, I bet you a lot of people remember exactly where they were when they heard their first Beatles song. So I'll just listen off the air. Thanks.
Okay. You touched on two very big things. One is that the Beatles were absolutely radical at their time for being so transgressive. And one of the ways that they were transgressive was actually sexually transgressive, which we no longer see in them. We no longer recognize when we look at the Beatles or we hear them. But those bangs were scandalous at the time. You know, and the falsetto way that they sang "woo" together, and their British accents that Americans always take as effete, even though they were working class accents, they were from Liverpool. Americans don't always get those distinctions. Two men singing at one microphone with their lips about 3 inches from each other, and also singing songs in many cases in their early days that were written for women to express a girl's point of view. Ringo sang Boys, which is a song about dreamy boys and wanting to kiss boys. John used to sing Will You Love Me Tomorrow. The other really interesting thing about what the caller just said is that the Beatles struck him because he was 14 years old, and there's actually been some cognitive science and some social science on the importance of the age 14 in our developing our sense of self, our sense of identity in relation to our own community and the larger culture. And 14 is the age when we find ourselves, and our own sense of self is connected to our taste, specifically to our taste in music. I did a piece about this for the New York Times a couple of years ago that people could look up. If you just Google David Hadu, H-A-J-D-U, and 14, you'll see it. And one of the things you'll find is that the reason that Paul McCartney, John Lennon, went into music, even though John was an art student, was that they were 14 at the time of Elvis Presley and Little Richard.
Thanks a lot for that call. David, we're running short on time. I wanted to ask you a question about generations, parenting, and music. I'm a parent of kids at that age. You've been through that. I like some of their music. I try to enjoy it. Is that parenting malpractice? Should I just let it be their thing and keep my mouth shut, even if I do happen to like, you know, a Justin Bieber song?
Well, a sure way to spoil things for them is to show that you like it. You know, I love the last Justin Timberlake album, the 2020 Experience, but I can't tell that to my son. So I just have it on my iPod. I listen to it myself, but I can't share that because it'll spoil it for him. I remember my father once. I was listening to Dylan. I was the Free Will and Bob Dylan, which has some beautiful songs on it. And my dad, you know, walked past my room and he said, "Hey, that's pretty good." And I didn't want him to like this. You know, go away, old man.
Well, David, that's a good place to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
A lot more ground we could have covered. That was David Hadu. He's a music critic for The Nation, professor at the Columbia University School of Journalism. He talked to us about his new book. It's called Love for Sale, Pop Music in America. I want to throw this out to you now. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. What is the first pop music song, however you want to define that, that really caught your ear, that really locked into who you were? And on the other end of things, what's the first pop music song that you looked at and thought, what are these kids listening to these days? You can tell us at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.